Hi, y'all. You're listening to In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile.
I'm Spun Counter Guy. Thanks for stopping by. Back on episode 225, we spoke with Jamie Prater, a man who had grown up in the Jesus People USA commune in Chicago, Illinois. In addition to making a film about the multiple cases of abuse that occurred within the organization, that film was called No Place to Call Home. Well, Prater has made a follow-up documentary called Love Song, where he speaks with a few more former members of JAPUSA and gives us an update on the commune's response of sorts to the problems raised by Prater and others. Now, if you haven't heard the first interview or seen either of Prater's films, it wouldn't be a bad idea to check those out before listening to this interview. And those films you can find on YouTube. But if you're ready to proceed, here we go. So it's been a few years since we last talked. And since that time, you have made an addendum, like a short film, to add to No Place to Call Home, your original documentary. So I guess my first question would be, why an additional film?
I felt, so here's a bit of history. So of course, it's been 10 years since the release of No Place to Call Home. About a year ago, late April of 2023, the Jesus People, then leadership community, released essentially an apology, a general apology on their website. And 2 days after they released it, they reached out to me and they were like, hey, would you like to meet with us? And I'd wanted to meet with them / go there for a while, but I'd kind of given all that up. But that whole gesture from them and the apology, I felt like, is there more story here? Is there more story to tell? Because honestly, and I've said this again and again, and I will continue to say this, that first film that I made, even though I'm glad I made it, wasn't the movie that I wanted to make. So I felt like this was the opportunity for me to make the film that I wanted to make.
According to the second film that you made, that you're not allowed to talk about what happened in that meeting. Can I ask at least why you can't talk about it?
They asked me not to disclose for whatever reason. I don't really know why, honestly, but I felt like because I'm a person of my word, I wanted to honor what they asked of me. And I felt like the only way that, because there's so much mistrust and distrust between former members of the Jesus People and current members, past members, whatever, I felt like I could do my part to earn their trust a little bit. So I thought, okay, I'll do this. But generally, I can talk about it.
Okay. So am I right in thinking that this apology that they put out is more coming from the newer generation or the newer management, less than the older ones that, you know, for all intents and purposes, were covering up the abuse and what have you?
I would absolutely believe that and agree with that assessment, that this is a way forward for them, and they felt like they needed to acknowledge. And really, that's kind of where the world is heading in some ways. Like, you can't, abuse just isn't tolerated. Hiding abuse isn't tolerated. And I think they wanted to pick up and move on as a community. And I think that they thought the way that they can do that, or a step that they can take, is to, number one, actually validate the stories of abuse and accounts of abuse. But number two, do it publicly.
There are several instances in your film, both films, of people that were formerly children in JAPUSA who say, yeah, I was separated from my mom and dad, you know, for some reason. Sometimes it was for some reason of the mom and dad, like they were maybe doing something that the leadership didn't like or thought that was problematic, or the child, there was something wrong with the child. Biblically, how did they justify separating families?
I don't know if there was a biblical basis for it. I think they just felt like there's people who are new in the community, they have children, but we want to assure, we want to assure them that their relationship with God mm-hmm. is on the right track, and we don't want distractions. And there are other people who are better suited for this, even though those other people didn't have children. A lot of them didn't at the time. And they felt like it was this responsibility of the community to care for the, of other people's children. Now, of course, the kids growing up that way and taken from their families did not feel that. Those offenses are horrible, gross offenses to the families and the children involved in those families.
Because I used to live in a communist country, I'm very fascinated with this whole concept, even though it's been mostly nightmares. But I try to give people the benefit of the doubt that, you know, people start with good intentions and it looks fantastic on paper. And I wish that world existed. But I want to get your opinion on this. So communes in general, first of all, do you think they could work?
Yes, absolutely. But I don't think that they can work with hierarchy. I think that communes are best run by everyone who live there, mm-hmm. Which will bring me to another point with Jesus people later on. I can kind of update you on their own structure. Mm-hmm. But I think mixing religion with any type of idea where you have people living together or this institution where there's, I mean, I guess a church would be different, but when you have people living together and you have religion mixed into that, that's dangerous. That's so dangerous because you have people saying, well, I think God's saying this. Well, I think God's saying that. Well, God's telling me you should do this. Well, we believe as a leadership team that God's telling us this about you.
Right.
I mean, and you could be completely against it. You could not agree with it at all, but because your religious authority is saying this to you, you have to either go along with it or leave. It's dangerous. It's so dangerous.
In regards to communes that you think would work, have you visited other communities to see like how they're working or how they're not working, or have you explored that much?
I haven't really explored that. I have friends who live in the Bruderhof, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with. So the Bruderhof is on the East Coast, big, huge Christian community, but they're more akin to not Amish, but what's the other one?
Mennonite.
They're a form of a Mennonite community, but they're more liberal. But they've really changed over the years and made changes to their structure, and they continue to survive. A really good friend of mine moved in from the Bruderhof to Jesus People years ago, and we were roommates, so we could kind of share that story of growing up in an environment like that. Mm-hmm. But I haven't really visited any other. I have spent time in, I guess, other non-religious communities, and I much prefer that because you can question things and not, there's less certainty, there's less judgment, and people aren't coming from this kind of moral religious high ground. They're just people. And when it seems to work better without the religion mixed into it.
I'm a history professor, and we have to talk about the progressive age in American history. And in that, you had different opinions. And so probably the most famous person in the, wasn't quite communal living, but something like that, shared living, would be Jane Addams in the Hull House, which was up in Chicago, up in your neck of the woods.
Yep.
But one thing that was different about her, and I think some people don't realize it, is she seemed more to be about people voluntarily coming in. She encouraged them, but she wasn't as forceful or say, we all have to live this way. I would say she was in contrast with a guy named Walter Rauschenbusch, who was a Baptist progressive preacher from that time. But he was willing for the government to step in and start pushing what he called re-socialization of everything from property to, you know, lifestyle. Do you think that makes a difference that if people can voluntarily come in, that there'll be a better situation, or does that not matter, do you think?
Well, I guess I have to ask you what you mean by voluntary going in voluntarily, because Jesus People is a system where you enter voluntarily, you leave voluntarily. But you are obviously subject to those guidelines and laws and rules or whatever while you're living there.
I guess, of course, that they were volunteer, but at least I remember our conversation with Jace Severs, And he made it clear that, like, if you decided to leave, you were pretty much dead to the community, and they weren't going to help you out. I don't know if they gave him even much money to get started, even though he had for years worked there, and I guess all his money that he had earned had went into the kitty, so to speak. And so, of course, that's not, they're not forcing anybody to do anything, but there is kind of a consequence, that's for sure.
There is, and or there was. A lot of people worked and or came in and gave hundreds of, some people had a couple hundred thousand or $100,000 that they gave to the community, and when they left with nothing. Mm-hmm. That was a painful reality of living that way, where it costs you, and it not only costs you, the longer you stay there, it's almost like the longer you needed to stay there because you didn't get money paid into your Social Security. So, I mean, I know plenty of people who are more like parents for me, who I was there when I was a kid, who they have to continue working into their late 70s because they didn't have enough money in their Social Security. I mean, they'd get like $100 or $2 a month. Mm-hmm. So that was, and there was no system at Jesus People to pay into anything. They'd claim you for tax reasons, but there was no money going into Social Security. So it made it really tough for people.
You feel like this should ever be pushed on people? At some point, like, our whole government and our whole society should become a commune of sorts?
No, I mean, I don't.
I know some people who do. That's why I ask. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I love community. I love it. I mean, I was raised in it. I was raised to live in it. Yeah. I was raised to love hundreds of people in very different ways. My heart is built to love many people in many different ways. Like, it's a beautiful thing. And I think as a people, as a species, we are built for community. I think we are meant to live in community. Now, a communistic environment is a different thing, where there's, you know, you have this hierarchical structure, and you have these people or a person or whatever making the rules, and it's trickling down to us. That I would never agree to. But I think, do I think we'd be better as a society living in a communal setting? Absolutely. But it would, I think, I imagine that holistically and by organically, as opposed to religiously or politically, for that matter. I think when politics and religion get involved in people's lives, it's a messy thing.
Would you ever start your own intentional living community, do you think?
Oh boy. I'm too scarred, I think, from my past to ever do that. I don't even think I'd ever move into one. I miss community. I love it, and I seek for it, and I look for it. But communal living, living with other people, it'd have to be a special place, right, for me to do that again. Yeah. And I certainly wouldn't raise any children in that environment.
I assume you still talk with your parents about that whole experience. And where are they at now, like, with their faith, if you can answer that question?
Yeah, I can answer. My parents are definitely... they're researchers, they're progressive people. They certainly have a faith still, but it's changing and growing, and they don't believe in many things that they used to believe in, or they believe differently. Their scope is wider as opposed to so narrow as it was before. And I think that's what, in my opinion, because I definitely wouldn't call myself a Christian anymore, but I'm a person of faith still. And I think that, and knowledge that we are living in a world where something is happening that is larger than ourselves, where we are bound together with something larger than ourselves, and that thing is love. But it's not just, I'm not saying, oh, hippie, it's just love, man. I'm not just saying that. Mm-hmm. But definitely faith, and I think the best faith grows and changes. It's a living thing, as it should be. And some of it, for me, the Christian structure just doesn't work for me. There's too much pain there. I mean, when you have something wielded at you as a weapon for most of your life, like, it's just, some people can make peace with that. I couldn't. So I had to kind of find my own way.
Well, that was my next question. I mean, do you think Japuza ruined Christianity for you? Did they ruin Jesus for you?
I don't think Jesus People ruined Christianity or Jesus for me. I am someone who is a researcher. I follow like some biblical scholars because I always want to know more. I want to understand more. I follow this man named Dan McClellan on Instagram, who is a biblical scholar, and he is amazing. And he kind of breaks down the data of the Bible in really fundamental ways. And I know that this is a popular word these days, but he aided me in my deconstruction of my faith. But I also really find the words of Christ beautiful. If we could live like that, I think the world would be a better place. But I'm not as narrow-minded as I was in terms of who God might be and who God might speak to or love as opposed to who God might not. Like, I think the world is much bigger than we understand. I think whatever divine force is out there is much bigger than we could ever understand. And it's much bigger understanding than we could ever comprehend.
Did you feel like you had a faith where you actually were speaking with a personal God at one point, like when you were at Japusa? And is that still there, or maybe did you never have it? I'm just throwing things out there because you mentioned that word deconstruction, and that comes up a lot with a lot of people in the Christian music industry, for example. You know, some of these major people that everybody looked up to are all of a sudden saying, well, I don't know if I believe anymore. And you wonder, like, did they ever believe, or were they just doing what their parents told them, or was it foisted upon them, that type of thing? So what do you say?
So myself, I had experienced a couple of very powerful supernatural events in my life as a very early child that solidified my belief in a higher power. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Not just like, oh, I believe in God. It was, No. Something is real because I shouldn't be here right now. And these events happened and I shouldn't be here right now. So has my faith always been personal? Yes. But I'll be honest, I had a hard time connecting with Jesus. God made sense. Jesus didn't. Hmm. Not that I didn't appreciate and love Christ's words. But first of all, we don't know if Christ was even real. We just don't. There's no empirical evidence to say that doesn't even matter because it's mostly based on faith. But I'm not here to like question anyone's beliefs. I really continue to hold Christian beliefs as sacred because I know some really amazing Christian people. And I think this is a case by case basis. And I think if you throw the baby out with the bathwater, I think you're doing both the baby and the bathwater a disservice.
well put.
But I hold that faith near and dear. I know the Bible really, really well. I know tenets of the Christian faith so well. I have a quote from the Bible tattooed on my arm. I mean, that's how important it is to me. Mm-hmm. So yes, my faith has always been personal. Jesus was never, while those words were important to me, I could never really connect to that figure, but I could connect to the God figure. I could connect to something higher than that. And that was always eating at me most of my life. Like, this just isn't, something's not right working there for me.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No worries.
So do you feel like now the Old Testament appeals to you more because that's more about, you know, God or Yahweh and not anything about Jesus other than the predictions or the prophecies, I guess?
No, I would say the only thing that interests me in the Bible are the words of Christ, to be honest, the words of love.
But you just maybe don't feel like he was divine or he wasn't.
I don't know. I'll just say I don't know. And the older I get, the less certainty I have and the happier I am with that. I don't know. And I'm okay with saying I don't know. But again, I don't think that you can go wrong believing in and following that. I think Christ wasn't here to be worshipped. Mm-hmm. Christ was here to be followed. And those are two different things. I think Christianity has set up this thing where people are so busy worshiping and not busy following and acting and living and being Jesus to people on the street or their neighbor or their family or whatever. Yeah. Those, I think, are the actions of Christ. Now, yes, I have a hard time connecting with him. I just do. Mm-hmm. But again, those words are only love, and they are a stark contrast to a lot of other things in the Bible. Right. But again, if that works for people, that's great.
I'm probably like a lot of people where I sometimes have a hard time separating a person from their artwork at times. I'll give you for an example. Like I remember being a big fan of John Lennon and the Beatles, but then, you know, I started to explore what Julian Lennon had to say about how horrible he was treated by his father. And it just ruined at least John Lennon for me for a while. Now, later on, I learned to, you know, give people grace because, you know, I've made terrible mistakes or selfish decisions and all that. But it still lingers in my mind. There's other, you know, works of art that you're like, ah, crap, you know, he's a racist, what? You know, that type of thing. And it's hard to, it doesn't mean that that thing is not beautiful. It's just hard not to attach the two, the person who made it and the actual artwork. So that said, the art that came out of Chapuza. So, I mean, there was any number of bands, for example. Obviously, there was the Rez band, and there was it the guy with Spike? What was his name? Crash
Tim Davis.
What's that?
Yeah.
Crash Tim Dog. Davis, I mean, the
Crash Dog, yeah.
Yeah, the Crossing. There was all these groups that came out of that. Can you listen to that stuff today, if you even wanted to, and not have bad memories?
Absolutely. Like, that's the thing. And I will say this over and over and over. Like, there are wonderful things about Jesus people. Absolutely wonderful, amazing things. I am who I am. The best parts of who I am are because of them. Hands down. Yeah. And as I get older, I think back and I only can think of the good. Like, yeah, there's a lot of hard stuff there that needs to be dealt with. They need to deal with it. And if they want to progress as a people, as a community, they really need to actually understand what reconciliation and restoration is and walk that path. But that being said, there's so much good there. There's so much good. And I can listen to, there are songs by Glenn Kaiser and Rez Band that I absolutely adore. And I don't, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Just like growing up, I mean, I don't know what your childhood situation was, but just like growing up with your parents, there are going to be times where you have terrible memories of your father and amazing memories of your father or your mother. Right. You know, so what do you reject them completely? Or, you know, you say, these are people who make mistakes, yeah, just like I'm people who makes mistakes. So I will say this, definitely my opinion and my outlook or my look back is very different, because a lot of the people who grew up in Jesus people don't feel this way. They don't feel the kind of love that I feel. Some of them can't even talk about it and everything's a trigger and they just shut it completely down. I'm not like that. I love them and I always will. And I also will always call them to account to deal with the trauma left in the wake of the legacy leadership. Like, they need to continue to deal with this, but I will never condemn them or shame them or cast aspersions on them. I think that they continue to do wonderful and amazing things in the city of Chicago. I think they are getting better as a community. I think that they've implemented some amazing changes, but I also think none of those things matter until they deal with their past in the way that they should.
I think we all, as children, like, think about how our parents raised us, and I made mental notes like, well, I'm not going to do that when I'm a parent. And then, of course, you find yourself doing just that. Do you think that there's some things that you learned from Jesus People USA that you didn't like, but you find yourself doing it without even thinking about it? You understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, like, essentially, habits from the way that I was raised, for sure. I think a lot of... let me think about how I'm going to answer this. I mean, I know what I want to say, but so there's a lot of fear of the world, and I still have a lot of fear of the world, even though I've been in the world for as long as I was in Jesus people. And that fear was baked into me, indoctrinated into me as a child. Like, this is the best place you want to be. You don't want to go anywhere else. You don't want to live anywhere else. There ain't nothing in that world for you. So I feel like my challenge has always been not living like I'm an outsider, because you feel like an outsider all the time. You feel like, I don't really belong here. I belong in the community. Even though I know I don't belong in Jesus people anymore, who I am in my core feels like you don't belong here.
Right.
Being someone who is biracial, being gay, like, and then being raised in a commune, I'm a stranger in all regards, right. You know? And, it's hard to kind of, find my place in the world. And I attribute that to the way that I was brought up. And I think that's, it's dangerous to raise kids in an environment like that, because they can really struggle. But that's, again, this is my account. Everyone else is going to have a different opinion. And then maybe like, I would say there was a lot of harsh judgment for people because of what they did. Like, if someone smoked, they're going to go to hell. If someone had sex outside of marriage, they're going to go to hell. If you did this, you're going to hell. If you you did this, you're condemned. And I think sometimes it's hard for me to even, if I do drink, like, oh, should I? I've had two drinks. That's probably it. Like, that indoctrination kicks in. Like, am I still a good person if I have a third drink?
Right.
And that comes from what they instilled in me, you know? And I don't think about that begrudgingly. I don't think back at that. I'm anger or furious at them, like, you people, you know. But it's, they have to understand, as my parents have to understand, this is what I deal with because of the way you raised me.
Right.
Because of the way that you allowed me to be raised.
I was thinking about this recently because there's a book I'm working on that takes place in the 80s. And a lot of the teenagers that are in the book, they are big fans of, like, U2 and, The Call and all those, Peter Gabriel, the Bruce Coburn, all those groups that had a kind of a Christian tinge, but they were kind of like in the Old Testament sense, like calling out the different hypocrisies or the different injustices in the world. But one of the characters starts turning that focus on the bands themselves and finds that a lot of them don't stand up to that same scrutiny. And the other fans are getting upset with her, like, why are you doing this? Why are you being so judgmental towards them? And she's like, well, who raised me? Where did I learn how to throw stones? It's from these bands. And I think about that too, because that's something I've struggled with, because, you know, you get attached, it doesn't have to be those bands specifically, but you attach onto some kind of, subculture, youth culture, or some kind of political movement, and you. And then you find that you end up being kind of the thing you were against in a way. And that's why I asked that question, if that's something you still struggle with.
I'm someone who I can look in a mirror, and I think it's important as people to be able to look in a mirror and see things. Hey, this could be improved. This could be better. Mm-hmm. And I probably will never have my own children. But one of the reasons why I'm hesitant to raise children is I don't want any of my early indoctrination or any of what happened to me to come out with my child. Not that I'm not going to make mistakes. I will. Mm-hmm. Even in the best of circumstances, I'm going to make mistakes, because you do as people. But I really think that at the end of it, when you infect someone's affect someone's relationship to themselves and to possibly God or higher power or whatever, because of how you've raised them, they view that whole system as a threat to them. You've absolutely failed. If they walk completely away for something that's supposed to bring them peace and comfort, you have failed. And I think about, like, some of the mantras that I heard growing up. I would hear people say, we're worthless and we deserve hell. But God saved us. We would hear that over and over and over and over. Oh, our hearts are wicked and we deserve hell. And I remember thinking, well, what God would create someone that's worthless?
Right.
Why would God create someone that's worthless? Why would we? It never made sense to me.
Uh-huh.
And I still, within the last few years, I talked to someone who was still living at Jesus People, even though this isn't a Jesus People thing. They repeated the same mantra, I'm wicked and I deserve hell. I'm thinking, dude, what? Be easier on yourself. But the big picture is, if you raise people telling them that their hearts are inherently wicked and the deities are failed, they're going to be like, you know what? This isn't for me. Good luck with this.
Yeah.
You know, and that's unfortunate. That is the biggest travesty, is because I think that even the Christian God is, well, I guess this is probably, Jesus is all about love and compassion and grace. And when you raise people to believe differently about themselves, you've failed. And you've almost committed a crime.
I was raised in the Nazarene church. They weren't too bad about the everybody's going to hell thing, but you'd always have some loose canon who may have didn't have too much theological background or meant well, but they would, you know, try to scare people into heaven. But I do wrestle with this because I do feel like that we all are born selfish, and that's the constant struggle every day. Like, how can I not put myself above other people or ahead of other people? I do believe that germ is still in us, but I don't think that you're born deserving to go to hell. That's just, that would make God unlovable, a monster, as Thomas Jefferson would say. He was arguing with some people about Calvinism, and he made that statement. You have, with the predestination thing especially, like, you've made God into a monster.
Yeah. Again, my heart is built to reconcile. My heart is built to forgive and to be forgiven. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm after. And I would hope that maybe that they can, because they've changed their leadership structure and they are now self-governing, there is no longer a leadership team or a council. It's all governed through committees. So the community is governing itself. And I think that that's an amazing thing. So bravo to them. But again, until they can really deal with their past in a way that is appropriate, I just don't think it will mean that much. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that this happened.
One thing I do remember from our previous conversation is you said you had great memories of the Cornerstone Music Fest. And do you have any great stories from that time period? Because I only got to attend once, but I had a great time. And I still run into people that went, and they will always swap stories about, you know, everything from meeting people that you are still friends with today to seeing great bands and what have you. What are some of your better memories from being part of Cornerstone?
Oh, Cornerstone was so much fun as a kid. One specific memory that jumps out at me is, I believe Cornerstone was still at Gray's Lake. So we were at Cornerstone was at Gray's Lake until 88, 89. I can't exactly remember, but Charlie Peacock had a concert and he sang this song that I can't remember, but it was so powerful. The room, there was so much energy in the room. There was so much love that the audience just kept repeating the chorus of the song over and over and over for like 45 minutes.
Wow.
And Charlie Peacock kept coming out. And this was when Vince, his African-American who sang with him was still alive and was singing on stage. It was just a really, really amazing time. And I'm a big fan of Over the Rhine, as you know, as you can hear in the part two. And my dad used to do driving for the different artists that would come in. Mm-hmm. And at one point he picked up Karen Berquist of Over the Rhine, and I sat next to her and I knew who she was and I loved their music. And I was, you know, I don't know how old I was probably 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. And I was just like over the moon that I was sitting next to Karen Berquist. But just the people, the love. Cornerstone was a very different experience for Jesus people. So it was a time where we could go out into this space and be free, have a little bit more freedom than we would normally have within the confines of the compound or the community. And the laughter, the food, the shows, just the connecting with thousands of people within feet of you. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Creation Station, back when I was a kid, you know, which was the kids program.
Oh.
Yeah, that was really great. Artrageous. I worked in Artrageous for a long time as an artist because I worked for Cornerstone Magazine. And we would have all of these guest speakers and we'd have to put up the show the day before. It was great.
Being your Facebook friend, I know you're an enormous fan of film. I swear that when we were first setting up, I thought there was a face hugger on your microphone, but I could be wrong.
There is.
Okay. There is. I love Alien, the first one. I mean, I could watch that over and over. But and I see in the background you got a AT-AT.
Yes.
So tell me about your love of film. Now, I know that I remember Jace mentioning that at Japuza they would set up a projector and watch a film. And I assume that it wasn't anything too edgy. But where did you develop your love for film? Was it at Japuza or was it outside of that?
It was definitely at Japuza. we were a community that watched movies nonstop.
Okay.
Everyone was always watching movies. And when I was younger or a kid, they wouldn't really show that many newer movies to us. So we were raised on all the classics, mm-hmm. all the Frank Capra films. I mean, all the films of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the old Disney films of the 50s and 60s or whatever. That's what I was raised on. And so as I got older, again, you have a community of 500 people, a lot of them very eclectic, a lot of very eclectic tastes. And my love and my own style came out because I saw crazy weird films by certain people who are these big movie nerds. So definitely, I mean, I would watch, like, my love of cinema was certainly born, but there. But I was also raised by fundamentalist hippies who were big on social change, on Jesus people in their own way were a community that was essentially a whistleblower. They would call out people all the time in their magazine. So they raised me to be like that. Like, I would watch the X-Files nonstop. I loved David Duchovny. And it's funny because as I think about what I watched as a child, a lot of what I watched involved people telling the truth, despite it not being very popular for them to do so. And then I fell in love with Aliens because my dad introduced me to Aliens when I was like 12. And I would watch Aliens every day after school for weeks. And so much that my friends of my parents were like, hey, Jamie's watching this movie every day. It's pretty dark. Like, is he okay? But I was just enthralled with the character of Ellen Ripley and her force. And so I would say that movies raised me as much as Jesus people raised me. Like, I am who I am because of the movies and what I saw happening in movies and the possibility. And it was only because people around me introduced me to this.
Of course, you made your documentaries. I mean, do you want to get into making, like, narrative filmmaking?
Yes, my love is narrative filmmaking. I'm a screenwriter. I'm a writer by trade. I mean, I have a day job as a marketing manager, but I am a movie guy for sure. And, you know, my friend directed Fast and Furious 10. I was on the set of that about a year and a half ago. So yeah, that's where my heart is.
Look over your shoulder, tell me what's coming. Tell me, what is the bogey you're so afraid of?
Like, for me, I have had a lot of healing as it relates to Jesus people in my past. I'm in a really good place.
Yeah.
I don't even, like, I'm going to do, obviously I'm doing this discussion with you, and I'll probably do it with a couple other people for other shows. But I have no desire to sit around and talk about how bad they were or how bad it was. My future is forward. Like, I'm all about freedom and living my life and living the best life I can live and just showing love to people and being loved to people. That's what I'm about. I'm serious. Like, it's not a cliche. Like, I believe in love. I believe in, like, actually showing love to people and doing that as much as possible. And so that's kind of where my future lies.
Yeah.
And I don't want to continue looking back at the past. It's going to hurt my neck.
Right.
You know, it's going to break my neck.
Again, that earlier interview with Prater was on In the Corner Back by the Woodpile, episode 225. And the episode with another former JPUSA resident, Jay Sievers, is on 222. If you're in a theology mood, 289 is a good one, talking about the origins of and critical approach to scripture and belief.
In the Corner Back by the Woodpile is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can listen to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or podbean.com. If you'd like to send us some hate mail, you can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. See ya, and I wouldn't want to be ya.